All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our sixth and final session of Wrestling with Faith. Happy Hanukkah. It's great to see you all here tonight in our special edition room for the evening, and with our latkes and our jelly donuts and the warmth of spirit that we have together. It is wonderful to be here with you. So they tell a story about a flight that leaves from JFK Airport, a Delta flight from JFK to Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. And the pilot gets on the mic, gets on the intercom system before it lands, shortly before it lands, before they descend. And he says, "Thank you for flying with us today." He says to all those sitting in their seats with their seatbelt fastened, "Merry Christmas." For all those walking down the aisles, congregating and talking to each other, "Happy Hanukkah." So it was a December flight. So folks, this is a bittersweet lesson. It's wonderful to study Torah together. Bittersweet in the sense that we know that it's our final session of this course. Nonetheless, we have a really good one to conclude with. So throughout the series, we've looked at issues that might get in the way of our faith, that might challenge our faith in God, faith in Torah, etc. And over the last five sessions, this is what we covered. We looked at confounding conceptions of God. We looked at our innate sense of divine injustice. We've looked at our feelings and our sense of smallness and insignificance and irrelevance in the face of God. We've looked at our modern day values that may clash with Jewish values. And we looked at the seeming incongruency between science and Torah. We did that last week. So today we come full circle. We started the course talking about God. We're going to end the course. The last session is all about God as well. Okay, so what do we know about God that we've covered in this course? I'll give you the quick rundown. Here's the lowdown on God as we've discussed. Number one, God is bodiless, formless, limitless, and descriptionless. The best we came up with in lesson one is God is the undefined underlying reality of all that is. Undefined, because how are you going to define God? But underlying reality, because God simply just is. And isness. Anything that is in truth powered by God, and underlying it is divine energy. At the same time, we explain that God is not limited to the realm of transcendence. God is not only bigger than, God can also choose to be in the here and now, present in the limited realm of our existence, of our reality, of our universe, because to say otherwise is paradoxically to limit God. So this was a big idea that we said, that God is not just big, but also God can also make himself small, because again, otherwise it's a limitation. Great, so we established that God is big, and yet God is here with us, etc. But here's today's big question. After all is said and done, after all of the philosophy and all of the discussion and all of the conversation, all the reconciliations, the question remains, and this is the question we're going to address today, and that is, can you and I have a genuine relationship with God? Or is God, at the end of the day, simply too big to relate to? It's not an abstract question. It's actually meant to be a very practical question. Practically speaking, can we have a relationship with God? Or is God just something too big, something too, in our minds or hearts, perhaps too vague to actually have a real relationship with? So the title of the class today is For the Love of God, Finding Closeness with a God You Cannot Touch. So, for the love of God, let's figure out if we can have a relationship with God or not. So I'd like to turn the question over to you and ask you the following. What do you think? Can we be in a relationship with God? What does that mean? What does that look like? Anybody?
Yes.
Yes, we can be in a relationship with God. So what does that mean, and what does it look like?
Well, I mean, I think that's in part what you're doing when you're doing Torah study.
Okay.
I think it's in part what you're doing when you pray, is having a relationship.
So what you're saying is that a relationship is defined by the actions that we take. So studying God's Torah,
partially.
Okay, so studying God's Torah is activating or expressing our relationship with God. Praying to God, that communication is expressing our relationship with God. Okay, good. Good. What else?
Since we can't experience God, God's essence with our senses, then we're just left to basically experience God through energetically. So we can have if someone passes away, you're thinking, okay, where are they? Who are they? You know, how do I communicate with them? Same thing with God. So you get a feeling for what God is, and then you can, I guess, talk to that entity. Also, doing this book, because then you have a physical relationship.
What was the last thing you said? Sorry?
Doing this vote.
Mitzvot. Yeah. I heard something about voting.
Yeah.
Got it. No. I just misheard. Okay, good. So you're saying that the first thing you said was that there's an energy that can be tapped into that is less than tangible. It's not like physically accessible, but there's an energy there. And then you said doing
that through meditation and through conceptually.
Okay, good. Good. What else? How can we be in a relationship with God? And what does it mean to you? By the way, I think if I asked each of you what it means to be in a relationship with God, you would probably give me a different answer. Which is why depending on the day, we might ourselves give different answers. I don't want to define it yet, because I think it's a very personal topic and a very personal concept. Anyone else want to share something on this question? Right.
Everyone is a creation of God. So
right.
By definition, it's kind of like you're born as a piece of God, right?
Right.
So like it's a relation right here from the start. Right?
So you're saying relationship, if God is truly the underlying reality of all that is, then if you're in a relationship with anything, then and if you think about what that thing really is, then you're in a relationship with God. Good. Okay. The truth is, when we define what the word relationship means, there are two basic understandings, two best basic definitions of the word relationship. Relationship could mean simply an association between two things, right? Like the politics, always. The relationship between, what's the first thing? Relationship between unemployment and political attitudes. Somebody wants to study, what is the relationship between unemployment and a person's political attitudes? Does that mean that a person loves political attitudes? No, it means that, in this context, relationship means some sort of association between the two parties, correct? But then there's another meaning of the word relationship. What is that? Relationship meaning, what's the second definition? A connection, a real connection, right? Like a landlord-tenant relationship means how they interact with each other, how they feel about each other. In other words, when we use the word relationship, it can either mean a general association or it can mean some sort of connection between the two parties. Make sense? So the question is like this. When we speak about God and being in a relationship with God, which type of relationship are we speaking of? So let's explore this a little bit further. In other words, we might think that since God is so great, infinitely great, so the relationship that we might have with God is the first form of relationship, which is a sort of association, which means the following. We said before in lesson 2, which was our third session together, we said that although God is infinitely great, God reaches beyond this incredible infinite gap and divide. God reaches out and makes himself accessible to us by asking us to do mitzvot. Remember I gave the example of Einstein? Yes? It's okay if you don't remember. But Einstein is walking down the grounds in Princeton, and you're there, and he doesn't notice you, but then he asks you for something. When you do that, you now have a relationship on some level. Is that relationship the first form of relationship or the second form of relationship?
Second.
Why do you say second?
Because there was interaction.
There's interaction, but the first one, there's also... the difference in the first and the second is not necessarily interaction only. It's more of, is there an emotional bond between the two parties? Or is it more of just some sort of connection between the two or association between the two? So one could argue that when it comes to God, and God says to us, hey, do a mitzvah. This is what I want you to do. And we do it, so now we have a relationship with God, but is it an emotional relationship? Not necessarily an emotional relationship yet. So take a look at text. We're going to do this class entirely in a different order. I am DJing this class, and I'm mixing and just pulling tracks. We're starting with text number 7. You'll see as we're going to skip around back and forth here. Text number 7, this is a fabulous idea. This is taught in Hayom Yom, which is a book that's like a calendar. It's like a mystical thought for each day of the Jewish calendar year. Let's begin with text number 7. Julie, will you get us started? Page 186.
The word mitzvah is related to the Aramaic words vata.
Savta.
Savta. Isn't that the word for grandma?
Savta. This is savta. It's close.
Which means connection. One who performs a mitzvah connects with God, the issuer of the commandment. This is the meaning of the Mishnah phrase, the reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. The reward of a mitzvah is the connection mitzvah it generates with God who issued the commandments. This can be understood by way of an analogy from the physical world. A simpleton has an inner sense of bitul, nullity, before wisdom and the greatness of the sage, to the extent that, in comparison, he senses himself to be an utter non-entity. Similarly, in the sage's estimation, the simpleton is hardly human. Not that the scholar dismisses or rejects the simpleton, God forbid, for that would be bad manners, but he simply sees no connection or relationship whatsoever.
Like we said about Einstein, when I used the analogy, I based it off of this, when we use the analogy of Einstein, it's not that Einstein is being rude or dismissive or intentionally like not nice, but he's existing in a world of ideas and he's simply not paying attention to someone who's not in that realm of conversation. Please continue.
Now, when the sage instructs the simpleton to do something for him, that command brings the simpleton into being. In the simpleton's own self-perception, he is no longer a non-entity. He has assumed a status onto himself in that he is able to carry out an order of the sage, and it is him that the sage addressed and instructed. In the eyes of the sage, too, the simpleton now exists. He is someone to whom the sage can speak and instruct. What is more, the command actually unites the lofty, exalted sage with the simpleton. The analog is obvious. It is understood that in the above analogy, it makes no difference whether the instruction regards a great and lofty matter or a simple and trivial one.
In other words, the mitzvah, the command, the instruction, doesn't have to be, can you split the atom for me while I tie my shoe? It doesn't have to be something major. It could be something simple. Can you get me a glass of water? The point is here, where in the world of the sage, the simpleton didn't exist. And even in the mind of the simpleton, he didn't exist, he or she didn't exist, in the eyes, in the world of the sage. And now, through this instruction, or this request, and the person fulfilling the request, suddenly this fellow exists, and now there can be a connection between the two. But the way we're going to understand this tonight is that this is still not an emotional connection. It's not an emotional relationship. Right? Now the person, the simpleton, might have a great story. Oh, you know who I met? I met Einstein or this great sage, and he asked me or she asked me to do such and such and whatever it is. Maybe a great story. But this doesn't forge an emotional bond between the two parties. What this does is, this brings the two into the same realm of reality or existence. This makes a very basic association or connection between the two parties. And based on this idea, one could have a conception of a human being's possibility in relating to God. When I say possibility, what I mean is, what is the ceiling of possibility vis-a-vis our relation with God? Human being is finite. A human being is tiny, 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 tiny compared to the entire universe, the heavenly realms, let alone an infinite God, right? Infinite versus really small and finite. Immortal versus mortal. There's no correlation, there's no connection between the two. There's no like equivalency between the two. Okay, but comes along a mitzvah. God says, I want you, human being, I want you to do this. Take this piece of paper and move it over there. And when you do that, boom, now you have a connection. What type of connection? The first type of connection. Now you have an association. I don't like these examples. I'm not... Yeah, right? These are throwing me off.
Mm-hmm. Landlord and tenant don't have a very good relationship.
Right. So here's what we do. Oh, look at that. The power of the remote. Don't worry, we can always bring it back. We can. Just takes a few clicks. All right, we're going to leave that aside. Those are throwing me off also. So here's the deal. PowerPoint's created by JLI, who also decided to order the text, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, in their order, which I'm not agreeing with tonight. The point is like this. Based on Hayom Yom, this teaching, text number, which one did we just do? Text number 7. You and I might have an understanding of what does it mean to have a relationship with God. It means that although we begin in a place where we have nothing in common with God, God gives us a certain common ground, a certain common ground sandbox to play in. God says, I'm going to create a world, put you in it. I'm going to ask you to do these tasks in this world. Do it. And that's what I want. Now we do it. Boom, we have a relationship. Is that an emotional relationship with God? Or is it a functional relationship with God?
Could be both.
But is God giving us an emotional thing or is it a functional thing? It's a functional thing. Right? It's a functional experience. God is saying, do this, don't do that, go here, you know, light those candles, right? Sing those songs, eat that food, right? All this, that, and the other. Did I mention Jews and food coming up in January? I think I just did. So it's a functional relationship, right? And again, a person might think, well, that's the utmost, that's the most I can get. The closest I can get with God, the best I can hope for in a relationship with God is that God asked me to do something and I did it. Like the example of the Einstein or the great sage. God asked and I did it and now I'm connected. An emotional connection. A connection of heart and feeling. I don't know. The connection here is a very pragmatic one. It's a practical one, utilitarian one. God has a need. Not that God actually has a need, but God chose to have a need. Right? God created a world that's broken intentionally. And God says, I need you to fix it. And then we do it through mitzvot. Okay, so now that's a functional relationship with God. So there's the functional relationship and an emotional relationship. And it would seem, based on everything we've studied up until now, and text number 7, which we just read, that our relationship with God, at the highest level, is a functional relationship. We do something that God wants us to do, we make the world a better place, and life goes on. And somebody might say, you know what, that's fine. What else do I need? I don't have an emotional relationship with God, but who cares? Why do I need an emotional relationship with God in the first place? As long as I'm doing what is being asked of me, right? As long as I'm bringing Einstein the cup of water, as long as I'm lighting the candles, fine. Do I need to also love Einstein? Do I need to love the sage? Do I need to love God also? Who says, maybe I just do what I need to do and that's it? All right, so here's the problem. The problem is, the problem is on a few levels. Number one, without emotion, and this is something that you and I know through experience in life, without emotion, behavior is not sustainable. In other words, there's only so long that you can force yourself to do something that you're not feeling excited about doing. Right? Give me an example of something that you don't want to do. Okay, you don't have to give me an example. Okay, whatever it is. Think of something. You don't have to share. Right? Just... Everyone think of an example, on your own, of something that you don't enjoy or that you didn't enjoy doing, right? And then think about what it feels like to do that on a consistent basis, day in, day out, day in, day out. It's annoying, right? It's difficult. Is it possible? Is it possible that a person might lapse in doing it because they're not interested in doing it? Have we seen in our own experience that there are things that we don't enjoy doing that have fallen by the wayside? We've stopped doing them precisely because our heart wasn't into it. I would say, I would posit that the things that we've done, that we've stopped doing, like a good resolution, whatever it is, that we've stopped doing, it may be traced, perhaps strongly traced, to this notion of not feeling it. We might have been excited when we started it, but at some point the excitement waned. Our heart was not into it anymore. It was then annoying, like it became a bother, a burden, and eventually we dropped it. How long can you hold on to a burden for? You know, a week, 6 months, a year, 10 years, how long is it going to last? It's not going to last forever. I mean, we don't last forever, but I mean, like, it's not going to last for an extended period of time. You know, the phrase that I use is white knuckling it. White knuckling means like you're just holding on. You're just holding on. How long can you hold on for? Huh?
Until you give way.
Yeah, until you give way, until you can't hold on anymore. So if your heart's not into it, the problem is that none of this is sustainable. When I say none of this, Judaism, Torah, mitzvot, it's not sustainable if our heart is not into it. At some point, we're going to tire of doing something that we've been asked to do. At some point, if we don't care about Einstein, at some point, you know what's going to happen? Einstein is going to say, oh, hey, get me a cup of water today. And you're going to say, I'm sorry. I got something else to do. I got other stuff, right? It's going to happen. I mean, think about a human relationship. Think about a human relationship. How long, if you don't love the other person, how long can you really keep on doing for the other without the element of love? It's not sustainable. I mean, maybe it'll last for a little bit, you know, running on, running on the vapors of what once was this actual love that was felt. But if it's not felt, how long can it last for? The action, the behavior. So hoping that you and I are going to act in a way of a relationship with God without the emotions is simply untenable. It's not realistic. It's not realistic. Day in, day out, to keep on doing or to keep on not doing for God when you don't have any feelings for God, how that's not sustainable. So take a look at text number 5. Text number 5 speaks to this idea. This comes from the author of the founder of the Chabad Hasidic movement, and he expresses that in his book of Tanya. Roger, please read text 5, page 184. I want to stop you for a second. Did everyone catch that? Look what he says. Love of God motivates us to do what? To do the 248 commandments of the Torah that are the action-oriented ones. Like do this, do this, do that. Right? So that's what, it's motivated by love. Without this love, our mitzvah observance is deficient. You have to, one must truly love God. Okay, continue.
From wrongdoing. A greater level of awe derives from a keen awareness of God's greatness. One with this awareness would be ashamed to defy God by doing what is evil in his eyes.
So we have 2 points. So it's known, let me explain. There are 613 commandments in the Torah. They are divided into two general categories. 248 action commands, like do this, you know, whatever, do this or do that. And 365, what we would call prohibitions or negative commandments, i.e. don't do this, don't do that. Why are there more don'ts than do's? Have you ever been in a car with a student driver?
Yeah.
Giving instructions?
Yeah.
Trust me, you will be telling your child, don't do this, don't do that, more often than saying, do this, do that. Do this is drive straight down the road. Don't turn, don't cut that person off, you know, check your mirrors. There's a lot more don'ts than do's in that type of thing. So to keep someone on the straight and narrow, there's more don'ts than do's. That's the way it is. So what he says here is like this. Your do's and your don'ts, which are known as mitzvot aseh, mitzvot lo taaseh, the positive commandments and the negative commandments, those are driven by, oh, no pun intended, all puns intended always, those are driven by emotions, the emotion of love and awe. So love motivates action. Because you love, you're going to do for the other. And because you respect the other, you're not going to violate their wishes. In other words, if you love someone, you're going to do for them. And if you respect them, you're not going to hurt them, right? If you love them, you also shouldn't hurt them. But it could be that you... Anyway, this is not a relationship class, although we could get into it. But love, just because I love this person doesn't mean I also... Or this thing doesn't mean I also can't love other things. And that can create a conflict. So that's where respect comes in. When I have respect... or a sense of awe, a sense of dignity about that other person, I respect their dignity, then that will keep me from crossing the boundaries and the borders of that relationship and doing something that will prevent me from doing something that hurts the other person. So love motivates action, and a sense of awe or fear or respect motivates, in a sense, inaction or refraining from doing something that is otherwise hurtful to the other. So when it comes to our relationship with God, the Alter Rebbe says, God says, do this and don't do that. Again, good luck trying to just white-knuckle it without the emotions. It's not sustainable. But if you love God, if you can somehow generate a love for God, then you're going to want to do what God says. And if you generate an awe and respect for God, you're not going to want to do anything that God doesn't want you to do. Make sense? Yes? So when we have the emotions, it makes the behaviors, either action or inaction, positive commandment or negative commandment, it makes it that much more sustainable. So that's text number 5. Any questions on that, or does that make sense?
Couldn't you do it out of practicality? For example, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
So I have to do that because I love God, or because I think that it's probably bad for society.
You know what the Rebbe once said? The Rebbe said that he was in Germany before World War II. Rebbe studied in the University of Berlin from 28 to 32, or 32 to 36. I don't remember which years. The Rebbe studied in Russia. He grew up in Russia. He studied in Russia in university. He studied in Berlin, and he studied in Paris. The Rebbe said, "I was in Germany. Talk about a sophisticated people. Oh, they were smart, sophisticated." Scientists, engineers, musicians, poets, artists, the whole deal. Here's the thing about the mind. The mind can justify anything.
But a lot of times the killing can be for the love of God.
Yeah, that's something else. That's something else. You're also right. Correct. Correct. Yes, that's another problem. But let's deal with one thing at a time. We're going to fix everything here tonight. But one thing at a time. The point is like this. The reality is that there's a reason why thou shalt not kill is one of the Ten Commandments. And Judaism believes that it requires a foundation of belief in God and love of God and being in awe or fear or respect of God. A person, another human being is created in the divine image. Don't take the divine image. If you take a person's life, it's like you're destroying an entire world. If you save a person's life, it's like you're saving a whole world. These are fundamental teachings, and they're driven, ultimately, at least in the Jewish understanding, they're driven by a higher framework in order to keep us in check so that we can say, can justify, well, you know, it makes sense. These people are really this or really that or the other. You can't get away with that when you have a certain absolute situation. Now, can God be distorted? God's will be distorted, And suddenly, can a person say, well, God spoke to me and said that I need to do so and so, that goes against the Torah? Yeah, people could do anything, could say anything, and people might follow that. But if we look at the core of what Torah teaches, you know, thou shalt not murder is pretty pretty straight up. It's in there, and there's a reason for it. So, and again, from the Jewish and a mystical perspective, it necessitates that higher, it being framed in a higher value as opposed to just something that's up to us. Because if we came up with it, we can also limit its application. Like, if it's because of us, then we can say, well, now it doesn't apply. Like, thou shalt not steal unless the person left the cash register open and they needed the money, and by divine providence, it's exactly the amount that I needed and it's right there, and maybe I'll pay it back later and whatever. Then I can justify it if it's up to me, if it's an absolute, and I'm in awe of God and I respect God and I know that God is right here and etc. Or I feel that presence, then it's something else. So this is a way in which we see, not a way which we see, but this is the meaning of text 5, the idea that all mitzvot, in order to really do them correctly, it requires an emotional connection. Take a look at text number 4. This is true of prayer as well. Ayla, please read text number 4, page 183.
Know that words are associated with the physical tongue, while thoughts are the domain of feelings of the heart. The words of prayer are the body and the thought and spirit. When one prays with the tongue, while the heart is preoccupied with something other than the prayer is like a body without a spirit, a husk without a heart.
Thank you. If somebody opens up a prayer book and reads the prayers with their mouth, they utter the prayers, right? But without kavanah, without intention, what does Rabbeinu Bachaya say? What is it like? It's like a body without a soul. There's no spirit. There's no spiritual connection. In other words, what's a body? What do we call a body without a soul? What do we refer to that state?
Death.
Right? It's a corpse. It's a dead body. It's death. So prayer. He focuses on prayer. Rabbeinu Chaya speaking of prayer. Prayer without emotion, without feeling, without intention, and intention doesn't mean intention in the mind, but it means intention in the heart. Prayer without heart, prayer without emotion is empty. It's dead. It's dead prayer. It's dead. It's lifeless. It's lifeless words. So again, if you and I thought perhaps that we could get away with just doing what it is that we need to do without an emotional connection, number one, it's not sustainable. It's not going to last for too much. How long can you just keep on doing without feeling, number one? Number two, even when you're doing it, it's a lifeless experience. You see how we're doing this? Again, number one, it's not sustainable. Number two, even whilst it's happening, it's not alive without emotion. It's a dead experience. Another way to look at it along these lines, text number 8. Text number 8, I was serious when I said we're skipping around tonight. Text number 8, which is page 188. Alana, please read.
Awe and love are figuratively called wings. Tikkuni Zohar explains that those who study the Torah and perform mitzvot out of awe and love are called children of God. Otherwise, they are called fledglings that cannot fly. Just as the wings of a bird are not essential parts of the body, its life does not depend upon them. As we learn, if its wings were removed, it is kosher. The essential parts of the bird are its head and body, while the wings merely serve the head and body, enabling the bird to fly. So too, by the way of example, the Torah and mitzvot effect the essential unity with God, because of God's will that is present in them. The awe and love with which they are performed, with the Torah study and mitzvot, and allow the will of God to be revealed in them.
Okay, so he says like this, the emotions, which we've seen before, the two primary emotions that are present in a human being vis-a-vis a human being's divine service are love and awe. In Hebrew, it's ava and Yira. Yira is also translated as fear, but I like better, A-W-E. Not A-W-W, like a cat video. Like a cat. Aww. Aww. So cute. Right, so that's a different type of awe. This is the other one. Okay, so what we... So love and awe, or love and fear. These are the two primary emotions. In general, these are two primary emotions. By the way, these are also directional emotions. Think about it. Love draws you in which direction? Close to the other person. You love, wow, I love that you get closer to it. Like, oh, let me see it, I love, right? It draws you close. When you're in, when you have fear, or when you're in awe of something, what do you typically do?
Step back.
Right? So the direction is either like, it's like magnetic forces. Either it's attraction or rejection. It's either closer or further, creating distance. So there's loving God, and then there's being in awe of God. There's getting close, and there's the movement of closeness, and then also distance. Okay, so what does he say here? He says, having these emotions, they are called wings. In Tikkuni Zohar, it refers to the emotions as wings. Why wings? So he says something interesting, which, by the way, touches on what we said last week regarding what constitutes kosher food. Remember we said that if it has a fatal wound, that thing's not kosher? Well, what if a bird's wings are clipped? Is it kosher? Is it having, it's not fatal, that's right, and that's what he says. So wings aren't essential to life, but wings allow you to soar. So he says like this, you can do a mitzvah without loving God and without being in awe of God, right? You can wrap tefillin and your mind can be elsewhere, your heart can be elsewhere. You could be thinking about the stock market and you could be loving, you know, I was thinking something sports related, but I was thinking to think Falcons, and you'd be like, oh, birds again, but whatever. Okay. So your mind could be there, your heart could be there, right? You could be totally distracted, but in action, what are you doing? You're wrapping the tefillin, you're lighting the candles, you're eating the matzah, but your head and your heart are totally elsewhere. Did you do the mitzvah? Did you fulfill the mitzvah? 100%. You did it? Yes. You got credit for it? Yes. You did it. But did it soar? Is it alive? You're missing the wings. What are the wings? Ahava and Yira. That's why there's two wings, right? Balance that. You have this side and that side. The right side is Ahava, is Chesed. The left side is Gvura, Yira. You have right and left. For those of you that took the Kabbalah course in the summer, you know my Chesed and Gvura, right and left, right? So that's the balance. You have the right wing and the left wing. It's not a hockey discussion, don't worry, but it could be. Could be. So what we have here is a simple construct. The mitzvah itself is action-oriented, but what allows the mitzvah to really take flight and to really be elevated and to allow our own experience within the mitzvah to be elevated and to allow it to be alive, like we said before from Reina Machaya, that requires the wings and the emotions, loving God and being in awe of God. If you have that sense of love and sense of wonder, and you're putting on tefillin, oh, it's a transformed experience. It's not just wrapping leather straps on my arm or light taking fire and sticking it to a wick on a paraffin situation. It's much, much more than that. It's a transformative experience for me and for the experience itself on an energetic level. So again, what's important to note here is that although when Einstein asks for something, for you to do something in the world of action, and you do it, that forms a relationship connection, a basic connection between you and the great sage. Bereft of emotion, number one, at some point you're going to stop doing it. Number two, even while you're doing it, it's not the same experience as if you were to have the emotions. Make sense? Mm-hmm. This is why in Judaism, the notion of having an emotional relationship with God is so very important. Another point regarding the importance of emotions and our relationship with God. We said in a prior lesson, again, I'm referring to lesson, our third lesson, but in the book, lesson two, We said in that lesson, we talked about four different benefits of doing a mitzvah. We asked the question, does God really need our mitzvah? And we answered, well, let's forget about God for a moment. We need to do a mitzvah. And we had four different areas in which the mitzvah is personally beneficial. The first was about the reward and punishment in the afterlife. Let's leave that aside for right now. We have a long time to talk about that. Joking. Good. We have three other levels of benefit. Number one, mitzvot in the here and now. Mitzvot, one, refine our character, right? Makes us better people. Number two, a mitzvah connects us with God, which is what we've said until now also. And number three, the mitzvot, make the world a better place and a brighter place. In all three of these areas, there's value in not just doing the action of the mitzvah, but also being emotionally present and emotionally charged in that experience. Let's take a look at text number 9. Again, I want to make sure that the point is clear before we read this text. The point is like this. A mitzvah has many benefits. It makes us more refined. It makes us brings us in connection with God. And it makes the world a better place. In all of these areas, you can either do the mitzvah without any feeling or with feeling, and it changes the totality of the experience in a fundamental way. Ray, please read text 9, page 189.
This code was given to enable the refinement of humanity. The performance of mitzvah refines us and connects us with God. This connection should permeate all our faculties and extend to the depths of the soul. Now, if one performs a mitzvah simply to discharge their obligation without passion, only their faculties of action are engaged. Consequently, their connection to God will be limited to their action faculties. It is God's will, however, that the entirety of the person and all of their faculties should be connected. This is accomplished by involving all of one's faculties in the performance of mitzvah.
Does that make sense so far? Again, the first two levels are, number one, refinement of self, self-refinement, and number two, connection. When it comes to self-refinement, if you're just doing the action, the mitzvah, on an action level, well, are you being refined inside? Is it changing who you are inside? Maybe not. If you're not feeling it, maybe it's not really changing you or transforming you. And number two, if a mitzvah is about connecting you with God, well, what's being connected? What of you is connecting with God? Your hand? Or your inner being, your inner self. If you're just doing it on an action level, kind of like from the hand out, then you're missing out on that on that type of holistic connection with God. Continue, nevertheless.
Nevertheless, serving God with one's higher faculties, love and awe, is not an end unto itself. The purpose of love and awe is to infuse mitzvah performance with life and enthusiasm. The objective of creation is to make a divine abode specifically of the lower world, which can only be achieved through utilizing one's lowest faculty, action, in doing mitzvot. The goal is only fully achieved, however, when the mitzvot are performed with all of one's capacities and faculties.
So this is a quote from the Rebbe, and the Rebbe is trying to, in a sense, straddle both sides of it. He says like this. If you do it without emotion, if you do a mitzvah without emotion, you're missing something. So let's say a person says, fine, okay, so I'll love God and I'll be in awe of God, but I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not going to do the action stuff. Come on, that's childish stuff. What, I need to take a box and wrap it around my arm or take a candle and light it or, you know, eat some flat bread on Passover? I don't need to do the rituals. I love God in my heart. And I'm in awe of God. I go outside. I meditate and I think about God and I feel all these wonderful things. I don't need to do the action stuff. He says that's also missing the boat. Why? Because at the end of the day, we live in a world of action. And God, we believe, God created the world for us to transform the physical world into a more spiritual place. And that requires taking the substance, of this world and transforming it into a mitzvah opportunity for God. So that requires action. Nonetheless, so love and awe is not enough. You know what we call that? We call that a cardiac Jew. cardiac Jew is I'm a Jew in my heart, right? I'm a Jew in my, like, I feel it, like a cardiac Jew. It's missing an element. It's like somebody who says, again, the best way to understand any of this is to just translate it down into human relationships. Imagine if your spouse says to you, can you do me a favor? Can you go to the store? I need something. It's very important. I need something. Can you go to the store and purchase this? And you say, oh, I love you. Not going to do it. And then they say the next day, oh, very important. Can you pick up the kids from this thing and that thing because I can't do it? And you're like, oh, I love you and I respect you, but not happening, not doing a thing. Imagine if that goes on a few times, many times, what's going to happen?
You're going to talk to your spouse's divorce lawyer.
Right. It's going to erode the relationship. In other words, at a certain point, you can talk about love and emotions, but without action, what is the fabric of the relationship? Right, without the actual tangible action, what's the, you know, you're missing the substance. It's like, it's good to have the emotions, those are the wings, but you need the bird itself. I know it sounds like a weird phraseology, but you need the thing itself, you need the connection itself. Then the emotions accentuate it and lift it up and make it deeper and make it more invigorated and more alive. But you can't miss out on the core. So that's what he's straddling both ends of the spectrum over here in text number 9. He says like this. A mitzvah accomplishes a few things. We said three things, right? Number one, it makes you a better person. So let's just do one at a time. It makes you a better person. So if I do this thing, it makes me a better person? Yeah. Even if I don't feel it, somehow, somewhere, it's going to make you a better person. But what if you do feel it? What if you're aware of it? What if you appreciate it? What if you love God while you're doing it? Certainly it's going to make you a better person and refine you in that moment in a more obvious way. Fine. Let's talk about connection, second benefit. This mitzvah, doing this mitzvah connects you with God. What if I'm not thinking about God in the moment? What if I don't feel anything about God in the moment? Does it still connect me? Yes, it still does connect you because you're still doing it, and doing it is what God asks you to do. As long as you're doing it, you're connected. But if you feel the connection, if you're thinking about God and feeling about God at the moment, of course, now you're connected not just with your hand, but in your heart and your mind. It's a whole body experience, that connection. The same thing is true with making the world a better place. Can you make the world a better place with just action? Sure. Can you make the world a better place without action? No. There was a commercial on the radio I heard a few years ago. I haven't heard it in a while. It's something about, you remember the time you almost donated or you almost, remember that commercial was playing on the radio? Maybe also TV, I don't know. But it was like, nothing happens when we almost do something. So actually step out and whatever it is, volunteer, whatever, but do it. And that's really the point at the end of text 9 is there's a value in actually, thank you, in actually, see that? We all felt that the door should be closed. But Rebecca, in action, in the world of action, actually made this room a quieter place. You see that it's perfectly timed. So you can want and you can hope and you can feel and you can know, but until action happens, nothing changes. So, of course, to make the world a better place, to make it a kinder place, a gentler place, a brighter place, you need to do something. But imagine if you do it with emotion, with feeling, with excitement, with joy, oh, it's even better. Okay, so what we have here is a very clear message that when it comes to our relationship with God, it can exist on two levels. Our relationship with God could exist on a very much practical, they're getting closer, you see that? They're like, oh, they closed the door, let's see if this is going to help. I did like lawnmower action, I don't know why, I don't think that's happening over there. Okay, so on one, we can have two forms of relationship with God. Number one, on a very behavior level. God asked us to do something and we did it. Okay, that's one level. A much deeper form of relationship is actually feeling an emotional connection, a love for God. Why is that beneficial? I'm going to summarize what we've said up until now. Beneficial on multiple levels. Number one, without the emotions, the behavior is not going to last. Number two, with the emotions, the behavior is on a completely different level. It's alive, it's deep, it flies, it soars, and it accomplishes in the full measure what it needs, what the mitzvah needs to accomplish. So we've now made an argument for the importance of feelings and the importance of having an emotional relationship with God, which is something we have not yet talked about in this course. Remember, this class is entitled For the Love of God. It's all about the emotional relationship with God, but again, we're trying to establish why this is important. Let's take things one step further before we understand how we can achieve that. One step further. Not only is it wise and beneficial to have feelings, emotions for God, it's quite fundamentally a mitzvah itself. There's a mitzvah to love God. Where's the mitzvah? You tell me, where does it say that we should love God? What's the most famous Jewish prayer? The Shema. And what's the opening after the Hero Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one? And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Right, that's the opening line of the V'ahavta, the first paragraph of the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. So fundamentally, love, feeling something for God, is an obligation. It's a mitzvah. Now take a look at this. Maimonides spells out, Maimonides, the great codifier of Jewish law, he describes all the way back in text number 2, page 180, he describes what this love is meant to look like. Rebecca, please read text number 2 on page 180. Listen to that. Listen to Rambam. Listen to Maimonides as he discusses what loving God is supposed to look like.
What is the proper degree of love that we ought to have for God? Our love for Him should be powerful and intense to the point that the entirety of our being is consumed with this love, such that it is constantly out on our mind. Imagine a man who falls deeply in love with a woman to the point that he cannot remove her from his thoughts. He thinks of her when he sits, when he stands up, when he eats and drinks. One's love for God ought to exceed this love. Thus we are commanded, you shall love your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Deuteronomy 6:5. King Solomon referred to this degree of love for God when he exclaimed, I am lovesick, Song of Solomon 2:5. Indeed, the entire Song of Songs is a parable that describes this intense love.
Thank you. Look at this imagery. He's imagine a man who falls deeply in love with a woman. He can't remove her from his thoughts. Whatever he's doing, he's completely obsessed, infatuated, in love with her. He can't think of anything else. And what does he say? A person's love for God should be greater than that. Greater than that. It's a tall order, but nonetheless, that's what Rambam teaches. That's what he says. That's what it means to love God with thought. Think of usually the beginnings of love, like new love. You're excited. There's a spring in your step. Oh, your heart is on fire. There's passion, everything. He says, yeah, that's how you're supposed to love God, with the same passion in your heart, like you love another human being, and even more so. It's incredible. Such a degree. It's a mitzvah to love. It's not just smart and good planning for the future, because otherwise, if I don't love, how am I going to keep on doing these things? And it's not just, vitalizing the mitzvah in the moment. It itself is a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah to love God. Rambam mentioned at the end of text 2 that this is the entirety of Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, was penned by King Solomon. And Song of Songs is, if you read it on the surface, it's straight up like a romance novelette. I mean, it's straight up like human relationships and love. We have an excerpt, text 3, which is very powerful. But the point is, you read it and you're like, wow, this is very, very intense, very romantic. But it's canonized. It's canonized. As one of the Chaf Dalet Sifrei Kodesh, it's one of the 24 holy books of Judaism. It's not just a love, a love story between a man and a woman. It's been understood from when it was first authored, from when it was first penned. It's understood for its true intention. It's not about human beings, although it speaks of human beings that are madly in love and that go through ups and downs and drama in their relationship, right? Although that's what it looks like on the outside, what the book is really about is about our relationship with God. The soul, neshama, we had that, I think there was a... Did we have that in the after the video, the lesson video? You remember the lesson video at the end of lesson one, which is why is God referred to in the masculine? Some of you stayed for that at the end of the class. So it was mentioned there, Mrs. Jacobson and Shandy Jacobson mentioned in the video that the neshama is feminine, neshama, soul is feminine, and God is typically our name for God in Hebrew is a masculine term. Okay, fine. So when we have this love song, this song of songs, this love story between a man and a woman, so the way it's understood is that it's a parable. The whole thing is a parable for the love between us and God. Take a look at text number 3 with this in mind. Okay, please read text 3, page 181. Let me explain who's actually talking. So the I is the woman in the story. And the humans in the way it's written, it's she saying, I was asleep, although my heart was awake, heard her lover knocking on the door, open, it's raining outside. Please continue.
But I tried to get up from the door. I responded, I have taken off my robe. Must I put it back on? I have washed my feet. Must I soil them again? My beloved extended his hand through her hole near the door. Upon seeing his hand, my feelings for him were aroused. I arose to open the door for my beloved. I sent it myself. My hands dripped with mire flowed from my fingers onto the handle of the door lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved turned and was gone. My soul nearly departed from me because of his harsh words with which he left me. I wandered the streets and searched for him, but did not find him. I called for him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who patrol the city found me. They beat me and wounded me. The watchmen of the walls took my jewelry off me. O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, what will you tell him? Swear to me that you will tell him that I am lovesick.
You hear that? First of all, you can ask questions on the story itself. The guy is trying... I want to break it down. He's trying to get in... She gets up to open the door, and then he disappears. What does he bail on her? Was she taking too much time to... Not too much time, but was he... He like didn't want to wait because she was getting ready or something? Who knows? And then what? She's wandering, and who are the watchmen that are... Anyway, whatever it is. It's not whatever, but there's a lot of detail in this story. But one thing that's evoked, it's just a sample of Song of Songs, is an incredible passion and a love that in this excerpt that she has for her beloved, for her lover. And it's incredible. And at first, you know, she didn't respond, but then she responded, and then he didn't respond, and then he bailed, and then she ran after him. Bottom line, she says, she tells everyone, she tells the daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, swear to me that you will tell him that I am lovesick. In the Hebrew, the language is so powerful. Shecholat ahava oni, I am sick with love. Cholat ahava, I am sick with love. That's like more than just in love. There's in love. There's falling in love, there's head over heels, but then there's love sick. That's a different level. That's like totally consumed to the point of even maybe personal detriment, but that's all that you can think of.
So that's addiction.
Yeah. Okay, maybe. Maybe. It could be. Right. All right. We're going to keep it in the positive element of it. Positive is, and it's such a love that the person, that's the only thing they can think of, and that's it's totally consuming. Look, Rambam says, look at Song of Songs, and there you'll get a clue as to what it means in the Shema, which, by the way, I said the prayer, it comes, the prayer is from Deuteronomy, so it's biblical, it's from the five books, 6:5. So, Devarim, it says in Deuteronomy, it says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. What does it mean? Be lovesick over God. Love God in this way that's unimaginable. That's like beyond what we can typically associate with emotions vis-a-vis God. Okay, so he says, as Rambam says, as Maimonides says, King Solomon referred to this degree of love for God when he exclaimed, "I'm lovesick," in Song of Songs, and that's what the entire Song of Songs is about. Okay, so we're at a bit of a crossroads. And what's the issue? Why are we at a crossroads? So we know that having an emotional and loving relationship with God is a critical piece of our spiritual life, of our connection with God, and our purpose as human beings. We also know that to genuinely love God is in itself a biblical commandment. It's a mitzvah. And it's spoken of beautifully and powerfully in Song of Songs. So here's the question. And this entire class up until now has been leading to this point where we're going to ask the big question. And the big question is, how can you and I feel a genuine, authentic, not a fake love, but a real love for a God that we can't see, that we can't hear, and we can't feel? You tell me to love someone, a human being, that a human being can love another human being, can be so consumed with that love and lovesick over the other? Yeah, I can understand that. Because they can see them, they can hear them, they can touch them, they can feel them, can relate to them. Makes sense. That I understand. Again, can the rational mind ever understand an emotion? Probably not. It's a different language. Right, but we can wrap our heads around it. We've experienced it. Hopefully, possibly, right? We've experienced this concept of love, and we know that somebody that you can relate to, you can have this love for. But we're talking about God now. And we said that it's not enough just to do, you have to love. And it's a mitzvah to love God, like you love your lover. To love God like that. A God that I can't see, that I can't hear, that I can't touch, that I can't feel. Where's God? How can I feel that? So if you tell me to pretend, okay, I can pretend. I can say I love God, and I have no idea what that is, what that even means, right? I love God. Sure, I love God. Why not? What does it cost me to say that? But we're talking about genuine stuff here. We're talking about being authentic. So the question on the table is, and this is the big question of the class, how can you and I experience a genuine, authentic, real love for a God that is, quite frankly, totally abstract? We said that God is not just infinitely big, but God also can be present here. Okay? You see Him? You see God anywhere? Let me know, right? You heard God lately? You touched God lately? So how do you love God? What does it mean? How can you love God? A God that's... Take a look, to put things in perspective, let's take a look at text number 6. Take a look at text number 6, page 185. Sarah. Page, yeah, 185, text 6, text from George Steiner.
The abruptness of the Mosaic revelation, the finality of the Creed at Sinai, tore up the human psyche by its most ancient roots. The break has never really met. The demands made of the mind are to lay God's name unspeakable. Brain and conscience are commanded to vest belief, obedience, love, and an abstraction pure, more accessible to ordinary sense than in the highest of mathematics. The God of the Torah not only prohibits the making of images to represent him, he does not allow imagining.
So this author, thank you, very poetically expresses how revolutionary Torah was, how revolutionary in its inception Judaism was and still is. How there's been in the history of religion, of any movement, there's never been anything as absolutely revolutionary and stark in its totality of what it says. So what's the big chiddush? What's the big revolution and novelty of Torah and Judaism? This notion of, but not just monotheism, an invisible, formless, imageless God. Right? The core of Abrahamic and Mosaic monotheism, like Avram and Moshe, Abraham and Moses, right? The core of that, the core of Torah, is that you cannot ascribe any imagery to God. You cannot shape or form or in any way concretize God in any way that is somehow accessible, which means that God remains imageless and in no way imaginable. Right? You can't imagine God. So go develop an emotional relationship with something that you can't imagine. What are you going to do? In other words, the bigger we make, the more like compelling we understand God to be, and this notion of God to be, the harder it is to develop an emotional relationship with God. How do you develop an emotional relationship with a reality that you simply cannot see, cannot depict, cannot imagine, cannot fathom? How? That's our question. Huh? It's a problem. I could keep on asking it for another 15 minutes, but we probably should touch on an answer. Right? Otherwise, it would be like, we would be running through the night saying, "Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, if you've seen the answer to this question, let me know." Right? Like, what's happening here? No. Hopefully, we're going to get some resolution. So here's the good news. When we have a question about how we're meant to feel something, like how are we meant to feel love for God? How is that possible? Judaism teaches that our hearts are in our hands. No, I don't mean that literally, like that would be weird, but our hearts are in our control, within our control. Again, those of you that have taken Kabbalah courses with me, we've discussed this at length, but this is something that's, for those of you that have heard this notion before, we're going to develop it further tonight. For those of you that have never heard this before, this should be compelling. See, and it's very different from the message that we hear in the world. The world tells us, society tells us, follow your heart. Right? However you feel, go with that. Yeah, if you like it, run with it. If you don't like it, don't do it. There's a certain deification of emotion. Right? Follow the dictates of your emotions, of your heart. Judaism and Kabbalah, however, teach something fundamentally different. And that is that we are in control of our hearts. No need to follow your heart. Your heart is meant to follow you. You're meant to be in control of your feelings and in control of your emotions. In other words, just because you and I feel a certain way or don't feel a certain way naturally, that doesn't mean that we can't alter it and modify it. So if we love something or are attracted to something, there's a way to modify that. And if we're not excited about something, there's a way to modify that. We are in control of our hearts. Again, it runs, I believe, this, and I said this before a moment ago, I'm going to say it again just because I think it's important to remember this. It runs contrary to popular belief. Popular belief is that if we feel it, oh, kadosh, 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 it's holy. Can't touch it, it's holy. Oh, it's, we feel it, oh, oh, if you feel it, I'm backing away. Although there are wires here, should be careful. Right? It's like Judaism says, don't deify emotions. Take it easy. Be in control of the emotions. Something to keep in mind. What's the Hebrew word for dog?
Kelev.
Kelev, the mystics say, is a combination of two words. Kulo lev, which means all heart, full of heart. Kol kulo lev, it's all heart. Kelev, it's all heart. And dogs, in truth, some dogs, maybe all dogs, are very emotional, very affectionate, very loving. But here's my question. Yeah? Who's meant to walk who? Are you meant to walk your dog? Is your dog meant to walk you? Who's meant to be guiding who? I'm not asking who, what happens sometimes, but what's a healthy scenario? Right? Healthy scenario is you, the mensch, the human being, you should walk the dog. Right? You should walk the dog. Kabbalah teaches that the mind is the mensch. The mind is the human being. And the heart, it's the puppy. Very excited. Ooh, steak. Ooh, sushi. Ooh, football. It gets very excited about things. It gets very excited and runs. Ooh, it runs. It wags its tail. It gets excited. Okay. Fine. But again, fundamentally, Kabbalah teaches, Judaism teaches, that you and I are meant to be in control. Of course it's passionate. It's fine. So pull out the leash and guide it, train it, bring it in, you know, contain it if need be. There are ways to modify, modulate, and work with your inner kelev, with your inner heart, with your inner puppy dog. Again, just because we feel a certain way or don't feel a certain way doesn't mean that's the way it has to end. Our hearts are in our control. Here is the language of Kabbalah. It says, Beteva, by nature, Hamoach Shalit Al Halev Betul Dato. From a person's, within a person's nature, Hamoach, the mind, Shalit rules over and controls Al Halev, on the heart. By its nature, the mind has the power of control over the heart. That doesn't mean that you and I can't choose to relinquish our power and let the heart run wild. Of course we can. If you've ever been anxious or jealous or angry or mad, if you've ever lost control on an emotional state, whether it's fiery, whether it's extroverted or introverted, right? If you've ever lost emotional control, at that point your mind lost its grip over your heart, or you chose at that point to not think and to let your heart run out of control. And that's like, you know, sometimes you let in the dog park, you let the dog run around and maybe it gets out and whatever it is, and you know, who knows? That's what it is. But by nature, Kabbalah teaches, Judaism teaches, it's mainly in Jewish mystical teachings, spiritual teachings, that by nature, the mind has the power to control the heart. Which means, if you want to feel something in the heart, or if you don't want to feel something in the heart, it's very simple. Change what you're thinking about. A person says, you know what, I don't feel good inside. My emotions, I feel anxious, I feel worried. So I'll ask that person a question. You're anxious and worried. What do you spend time looking at or focusing on? Are you by any chance reading the news, right? Or watching the news? Or paying attention to things that are presented as all doom and gloom and bad things? And then you tell me you're anxious. I have an idea why. Because the information you're feeding into your brain is very anxiety generating information. And what you feed into your mind is going to dictate what pops out on an emotional level. So if you want to feel different, you got to change what you put in front of your eyeballs. You got to change what's going in. What goes in is what's coming out. In the language of Kabbalah, the mind, and there are three parts of the brain, three parts of the mind, we're going to leave that aside for right now. The mind, the faculties of intelligence, are considered to be the parents, and the emotions are the children. And the parents birth the children, not the other way around. So if you want to feel different, if you want different children, change the parents. I know it sounds weird, but what I mean is, if you want to feel different, you got to change what goes in here, what you're thinking about. And so now we come to the key Hebrew word that's going to capture the entire answer to this question. And the Hebrew word is hitbonenut, which means contemplation. It can also be translated as meditation, but it's a little bit different. Meditation, at least Eastern meditation, is typically associated with clearing the mind, emptying the mind of distracting thoughts. Whereas in Jewish thought, hitbonenut, which is more accurately described as contemplation, means not emptying the mind of thoughts, but focusing on a thought or a series of thoughts to achieve a desired result. In other words, the core premise of hitbonenut is, if you think about that thing, this emotion will derive from it. This will be produced. If you plant that seed, this will grow. If you think that thought, not just think it, and you're done with it. Hitbonenut means also that you're actively processing it and holding on to it for a while. And I need to mention something else, which is very important. We live in a society that trains our brains to not pay attention to things for too long. Right? It's a reality, right? It's like attention spans are getting shorter. What was I just talking about? That's my point, right? So attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, and studies have shown this. Brain science is proving this. We need to reverse the trend. But you and I don't need to be slaves or subservient to whatever somebody thought would get our attention. We have to take control of our own lives and our own health and our own self. So, it begins with our heads. We have to be in control of our heads. We don't need to allow access for anyone else to decide what we think about, when we think about, how fast we think about things. That is giving away way too much of our own personal autonomy to outside forces. It's not a healthy thing. And again, a human being might feel lousy and not even know it's because the messages that they're getting lousy messages, so they're feeling lousy. It's like, oh, the world is terrible. I feel terrible. It's like, okay, enough said. Here's the point, though, about the attention span. Hitbonenut requires mindfulness. It requires a sustained mindful approach. And that is something that requires practice. In other words, can you hold one single thought for more than a minute, 60 seconds, without distraction? Can you hold a thought for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? How about 30 minutes? Imagine thinking one thought, a thought not that came into your head, but a thought that you want to think about, that you've chosen because you know it's a healthy thought and a productive thought. You've chosen what you're... How like revolutionary is this, but how basic is this, right? That you can choose a thought and think about it at your choosing for the amount of time that you choose. It should be so basic and elementary, and yet I would venture to say that even going over 2 or 3 minutes for most of us would be quite challenging. And it's simply for one reason. It's because we don't practice it. So Judaism and Kabbalah, especially Kabbalah, teaches the art of hitbonenut, which means... This is the way that Hasidic life is designed and it's centered around. That in the morning, you study. You study teachings of spirituality and Jewish mysticism. And you study ideas and you get them in your mind. And then you hold them. And you meditate and you... meditate, not clear in the mind, but you contemplate hitbonenut. You think about them and you process them and you work them over. But you focus on a thought. And then you dive and you pray with these thoughts in mind. And it's a transformed experience. So here's the core idea. What you put into your mind and what you focus on will inevitably dictate how you feel. And so here's the key point in relation to our big question. You want to feel a love for God? What are you thinking about? Falcons? Your paycheck? Carpool? Walking the dog? Well, what are you thinking about? How are you going to have a love for God if your head is nowhere near that? Right? Of course you're not going to love God. I don't mean it so harsh, but of course we're not going to have these overwhelming feelings of passionate love for God if we're not even thinking about God. So the first step to developing an emotion for God is to start thinking about God. And so when you study Hasidic philosophy and Jewish mysticism, you encounter multiple contemplations that we can think about to generate emotions for God. Some generate love. Some generate a sense of awe and reverence, depending on what you're studying. So I want to walk you through, we're going to do one. I want to walk you through one form of hitbonenut, one contemplation exercise. I call this, it's not in the original, but I call this one the reflective pond contemplation. So imagine you're walking through a forest and it's beautiful, but all you see are the trees around you. And it's fall maybe, so you see the beautiful colors of the trees. Why not? We'll make it timely. You see the colors on the trees and on the ground, and it's beautiful. And the air is crisp, and it's cool, and you feel invigorated. And then there's a clearing in the forest. And you see, through the clearing in the trees in the forest, you see a beautiful pond. And you walk over to the pond. The pond has water, and water is life. And so you walk over to the pond. And you look at the water, and it's crystal clear, and it's beautiful, and it's shimmering in the sunlight. And you walk over, and you look directly down at the water. And in the water, you see something remarkable. You see a face. And you smile, and the face in the water smiles back. And then you practice a frown, and the face in the water frowns back. Because, of course, the face in the water is nothing but your face reflected. King Solomon writes, "Kamayim ha'panim alpanim, kein lev ha'adam el ha'adam." Just like water reflects the face, so does the heart of one person reflect the heart of another person. Which means, when someone loves you, when someone shows you affection, naturally your heart responds in kind and you love them and you want to show them affection. And when someone does the world for you, when someone moves heaven and earth for you, you can't help but feel not only gratitude, but also a devotion, a reciprocal devotion toward them. Like water reflects the face, so does the heart of one person reflect the heart of the other. And so now I'll tell you a story of the king. There was once a king who leaves his palace. And he goes all the way to the outskirts of the city. And he goes to a very, very forsaken part of town. And there he walks over to a man who's living in absolute filth, in a terrible, terrible situation. And the king personally lifts him up and he carries him to his palace and he brings the man to his innermost chamber in the palace. And the king cleans him up. And understand the purity of this parable for a moment here. So let's not... The king cleans this person up and he hugs him. He kisses him and gives him, shows him incredible affection and love. A friendship, affection and love. Imagine you're that man. How do you feel? How else do you feel? The king just beloved. incredible, respected, loved, cared for. The king didn't have to notice me. The king is the king. And yet he came all the way down to me and personally cared for me and took me out and is showering me with love. You can imagine that this person would feel like water reflects the face, so does the heart of one person reflect the heart of the other. Imagine this person reciprocally would also feel an incredible sense of love and affection back toward the king. All of this is a parable for what God did for us at the time of the Exodus. And it's also a parable for what God does for us every single day of our lives. God lifts us up out of the worst places, the lowest places. Even if you think about it, in the morning when we wake up, God rescues us from the throes of death. God schleps us out, us up to safety and showers us with affection. He gives us life. He gives us love. He gives us everything. So I'll ask the question. If that's what God does for us, as water reflects the face, so does the heart of one reflect the heart of the other, how can we not be filled with just incredible love and gratitude toward God? What's the answer? Why aren't we sometimes filled with this love? Because we're not thinking about it. We're not aware of it. We're not conscious of it. Fine. No problem. So start thinking. There's a solution for that. Start thinking. The moment we recognize and contemplate God's incredible love for us, we will be filled with incredible love for God. This entire contemplation, the contemplation has now thus concluded. This entire contemplation, this Hitbonut exercise, is found in text 12. We don't have time to read it inside, but I want you to take this home. Your homework is read text 12, and if you are brave enough, I don't mean brave like in that sense, but if you are up for the challenge, incorporate this into your life. Incorporate text 12 into your life. Make this part of your ritual. Instead of waking up in the morning and having a slice of cheesecake and watching CNN, right, and filling your mind with anxious thoughts, think about God's love for you. And think about the blessings in your life that are coming from God, even if it's as basic as the breath you're taking in that one moment. And then you'll start to feel a gratitude and a love toward God. That's how it's done. And so today we asked a simple question. We had a very long buildup, but it was a simple question. How can we love a God that is so abstract? And the answer is, God is only as abstract as you make Him to be. God is abstract when we're thinking about carpool, and when we're thinking about football, and when we're thinking about food, and when we're thinking about paycheck, and when we're thinking about construction and all the other stuff that's going on. When we're thinking about reality, real things, life, blessings, happiness, the breath we're taking, inhaling and exhaling at every moment, when we think about the core things of life, and you recognize where it comes from, you can't help but for your mind to be filled with an awareness of God and your heart to be filled with a love of God. And so we now conclude the course. We live in a world of action. The world tells us that intentions and emotions are nice, but action is king. And on some level, Judaism also agrees with that. Judaism certainly puts a very strong emphasis on action, doing the mitzvah, getting it done, making the world a better place. But in this world of action, we learn tonight that we cannot forget about developing actual, real, and genuine emotions in our relationship with God. We can't neglect the pursuit of genuine emotions such as love and awe toward God. We just can't afford that. This is the power of Jewish teachings. This is the power of specifically the teachings of Jewish mysticism, Hasidism, and Kabbalah. They help us think about God in a real, compelling way and help us start feeling real emotions for God. And when it's all said and done, this is what truly constitutes our relationship with God. It's at the core of any healthy relationship. It's a two-step process. We feel, and then we do. I thank you for joining me for these last 7 weeks, for these six sessions that we've had over the last 7 weeks. I hope your spiritual life and your entire life has been enriched by what we've studied. and discussed in this course, Wrestling with Faith. I'm grateful that you've been part of the experience, and I look forward to sharing more study and exploration with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Can I share something with everybody?
Yeah, give me one second.